This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. Dr. Lyle, how's it going this fine evening?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice again.
Excellent. All right. So we got a couple of questions today. I titled the show after a question that we had, but we're going to go to that question later. It was the manipulation tactic question. So for listeners who are looking forward for that title, we'll talk about it another time. But we're going to be talking about a question from a listener about whether or not online dating might be worth it. Qualifying for a spouse, some attraction to pregnant women. Can't wait for that one, Dr. Lyle, right? And then liking animals after having kids. And then a couple of others if we can get to them. So,
all right.
Let's just hit the ground running, Dr. Lyle. Ready?
Sure.
All right. Here we go. Dr. Lyle. Dear Dr. Lyle, I found an article online and I thought it jibed really well with what you're saying on the show. And it kind of made me wonder that it must be extremely unlikely to find that magic 10% through online dating. Now, I find it extremely difficult, but I've also noticed the same faces across multiple dating sites and apps over a long period of time. A lot of them are attractive women, and it's strange to me that they haven't been able to find somebody yet. The only conclusion I can come to is that we're all more picky online, and therefore you're more likely to find your magic 10% through some sort of real life activity. What are your thoughts?
Yes, this is very good. This person sent us a copy of the article, and I forget who wrote it, but there's a couple of articles. I believe this research was, can't remember. I think this was University of Texas, which is a hotbed of evolutionary psychology. I think that's where it was done. I can't remember exactly. This was very interesting. What happened was, I think there's more than one study, but what happened was that they computed the correlation coefficients of like 100 dating pairs that had been dating, had not known each other before they began dating, so that they, just by talking to people, you know, when did you guys meet, when did you start to go out, etc. And they had a bunch of a total of about 160 dating pairs altogether, and about 100 of them, the people had not known each other at all. So they had essentially met online or something like that, probably had been mostly online. Or actually could have been in novel situations, could have been in a bar, at a dance, at a bar mitzvah, who knows where. But the point is that they had never met before, and then now they're dating and we're catching up with them 8 months later. And so the question is, are these people different than people who had known each other a long time before they started dating? And this is what they found. They found that the attractiveness correlation between the people who had never met and now are dating, that attractiveness correlation is very high. In other words, those people are very similar in attractiveness. The people that have known each other for a long time and then they dated after they had known each other for a long time, that correlation coefficient is very low. Now, this is astonishing. Actually, I don't want to say too confidently about the data, just because it was quite technical and I didn't have a long time to look at this, and it was statistically elegant, although I'm not exactly sure how to infer, I can't infer precisely what it is that they were after or what they did find. My first thought was, and I'm pretty sure they did not run this analysis and they did not report it, was that my first suspicion was is that the females were more attractive than the males, and that so the correlation coefficient is dropping because the when people have dated after they've known each other a long time, it's more likely for the males to be sleeping up. This would be completely consistent with what I know about evolutionary psychology. So what was found is consistent with what I understand, but they did not report that sex effect. All they reported was a lowered correlation between the attractiveness, so as if it could have gone either way. Now, I wrote to the author. Author's doing a postdoc at Purdue, and she hasn't written back to me yet. So hopefully when she writes back to me, I'll be able to report what it is that was found. So the other thing that was interesting, I wouldn't bet everything I own, but I'd bet most of what I own that I know what the results are. Now, the interesting thing about it was that the effect continued to get stronger. In other words, the correlation of attractiveness between the two continued to drop for a period of about a year and a half. And so sometimes people will ask me, women, when I explain that there's an overlooked opportunity that women are passing up, and that overlooked opportunity, and of course from this data you could say the men are passing it up too, but I don't believe it because I don't think that the men are included in this. The overlooked opportunity that women are passing up is that they will find males more attractive over time as they get to know them. That effect has been reported. Actually, that was reported by David Buss in some materials, I think, 20 years ago. But now this is a more elegant demonstration of this, and really convincing. Now the issue was what is the slope of that line as we start from a super high correlation when people have not known each other at all before they meet. And then we have essentially a decay function that goes all the way down, in this case, to zero. The correlation becomes zero at about 24 months. The slope of that decay function looked linear. Now, it's steep, but what I've been telling people is I've been telling women what I call three strikes and you're out. If you don't find any interest in the guy after three dates, then I'm saying get rid of him. You just call it good and move on to the next one. It's probably not a bad rule of thumb, but it's not. There's no huge logic to it because the truth is that the next three and the next three and the next three, 12 dates later, we still have the possibility. It continues to increase that the woman would be interested. So. You know, this starts to get complicated statistically, and we're not actually sure where the biggest piece of the pie probably is. But I would say my general rule of thumb: three strikes, you're out. It isn't. Because the decay function is linear, and it is not, in fact, curvilinear. Then I actually have to say I don't have any good empirical logic to defend it. But I can say that I still think it makes some kind of sense, something in that range. An additional study was done, and that was that people were in a classroom setting, a small classroom setting, and I believe this was in Texas. They had people rate each other for their attractiveness, and so it turns out at the beginning of the semester, the inter-rater reliabilities were very high. In other words, everybody who agreed who is most attractive and least attractive and in the middle. However, by the end of the semester, that correlation coefficient had dropped considerably. That is fascinating. And once again, I need to track this down and I need to see who dropped. And my guess is the more attractive men dropped and some of the average attractive men rose relative to where they stood. I don't know that would have been true for the females. Just being a guy and being around other guys and listening to guys talk, I don't see guys assessments of females' physical attractiveness drop just because you get to know them and you find out they're just a raving bitch. This doesn't seem to impact our aesthetic judgment and even our sexual motivation per se, particularly. So I don't think we're going to find that the reason for that correlation coefficient dropping has to do with males reducing their attractiveness or their attraction to the females. I believe it's going to be changing up inside the female brains. This is consistent with the fact that male mate value is more obscured because it's more in their brain. It's going to have to do with their behavior about what they can bring to the female in terms of protection and provision than is female mate value. So that is clearly what's happening here. So I'd like to see these authors clarify the sex differences about what they found. But the person who's asking this question is one of the great questions of our time. How are you going to find somebody? And what this is saying is, and what this research is saying is that don't overlook the concept of finding repeat exposure situations that have always been the root of most male and female hookups, most female relationships. It was work, church, and school, always has been. And so if you're in a workplace where that's not going to work and you don't belong to a church and you're no longer at school, you're in trouble in a modern environment. And and so how you're going to find the magic 10%, we may need to find places where there are repeat exposure situations where that you can get yourself into. So there are, you know, essentially clubs that you can join, service organizations, et cetera, places where you can go where you can get repeat exposure effects, and find situations where the opposite sex is gathering because they like to be there. If you're a guy, cultivate an interest in dancing. If you're a female, cultivate an interest in the martial arts or baseball or whatever it is. In other words, get creative and think through where you can fish where the fish are, and put yourself in a position to be in repeat exposure environments if you can. That's an additional tool. Don't rely solely on online dating because the online dating clearly is going to be driven highly by high correlation coefficients and attractiveness. And so what we're going to find, which is probably what we do find once we grind the data out, is that the highly attractive people are probably having a perfectly good time online, because it's not that hard for them to hit the magic 10%, and and everybody else is scrambling. That's probably what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, I just picked up by no intention at all, just randomly, I picked up a new hobby of painting. So, you know, wonder what those classes like, right, Doctor? You can probably guess.
I should pick up a yoga habit. That's the habit I need to pick up.
Well,
all
speaking
right.
Of the attractive people online, a couple of years back, an informal study done by some user at a bodybuilding forum where he copied mm-hmm. and pasted a picture of a stunning hot male model, and he made it mm-hmm. like all his pictures on his internet profile, and he detailed a blog about what kind of response he would get relative to his normal pictures and then relative to a picture of another kid who was extremely unattractive. And he used the same messages every time. And it's just phenomenal to see the response. He basically got away with saying anything, and the girls were just having no problem with it. So.
Yeah. As we would expect, this is a species that, you know, will use smell, will use sound, but mostly it uses vision to analyze gene quality. And so that goes for males and females alike. And so that's why we see this the evidence from this study that we just reported. Very high correlation coefficients when people don't know each other. In other words, if you don't know somebody, you better be able to hit their circuits immediately. And it's going to be through vision. Whereas if they get to know you slowly, you have a chance to have your inner beauty appreciated. And so that's what it is that it looks like. And I believe their sex difference is huge. And so the males, in general, if you're struggling, you need to put yourself in more repeat exposure situations. And if you're a female, you should also use the opposite of this, is that you want to you want to give people who seem like they are very good, interesting people, if you're meeting them online, give them a few chances if you find them interesting as humans, and then blow them off, you know, if you just can't tolerate it.
Mm-hmm. And
right.
So for our listeners who are interested in this article, I posted it up on our website or the episode description on blogtalkradio.com/beatyourgenes. I just linked it up, so if you want to read that article, you're more than welcome to. Okay, Dr. Lyle, let's move on to the next question.
Sure.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, why do you say that men aren't attracted to pregnant women? I find myself extremely attracted to my wife, and a weird side effect was that I also became attracted to other pregnant women. Not just any pregnant women, though. They still have to be attractive and relatively skinny in relation to being pregnant. Anyway, this is true. This might possibly be the worst adaptive evolutionary trait ever. Here, let me work super hard to find a good pair bond, only to immediately blow them off after I'm pregnant. Oh, darn, where did my pair bond go? I first saw this happen when I had two buddies years ago, pregnant wives at the same time, and they were falling all over themselves just to get to the strip clubs. I thought it was ridiculous at the time, but now I kind of understand it.
Yes. So we've got a pair bonder here who's writing to us. All good. So his wife got pregnant. He still found her very attractive. And I think that that isn't super uncommon. It is true that the most likely time for a man to cheat on his partner is when she's pregnant. Now, that is a statistical fact. His two buddies were obviously having those circuits go off in their heads, going to the strip clubs. I say this as a result of that data, and I also say this that because we can see the tremendous impact that excess female weight, particularly around the specifically around the stomach, does to reduce their attractiveness to males. So it follows that the reason why males aren't too upset if females get heavier and they maintain a waist hips ratio of 2-3. So there are women who are just naturally very large, and as they get heavier, they just get bigger, wider hips. They get big busts. Their waistline stays in a ratio to the rest of their curvature, and it does not reduce their sex appeal to the male. So it is specifically gathering weight around the waistline, which is a huge cue that the female is possibly pregnant. And so this obviously makes a big impact. So it's not going to be all men all the time to all women, but what we're looking about here is statistical averages. And as we see statistical averages, we see the underlying logic of evolution. Whenever we see that there is a universal human characteristic that shows up under certain conditions. So, good question. And I have also heard, and I don't know if it's an evolutionary adaptation, but I've heard from many women that when they were pregnant, they would sometimes become extremely sexual. And of course, everybody just says, well, it's these raging hormones and it's all out of whack and crazy and everything else. I'm not so sure that would be true. It strikes me that this could be an adaptive mechanism to essentially, even though you're less attractive, you make yourself far more available possibly to your pair bond partner and therefore keeping him around. So that, I don't know that anybody's investigated that, but that seems like a wouldn't surprise me at all if that turns out that's an adaptive mechanism.
Mm-hmm. And for anybody considering studying like this, what would be the implications if they found that this is in fact true?
You mean that this is an adaptive mechanism?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Then I haven't thought about it.
You stop prescribing hormone pills.
That's a pH. Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, that's a, yeah, that's a, we're going to, We can talk about that. There's a gal at UCLA that's a big time researcher in hormones and sexuality. Marty Hazelton, I think her name is. And so they're learning more all the time about the subtleties of hormones and how they influence human sexuality. So it wouldn't surprise me. I can't believe that Hazelton or her similar colleagues haven't looked into this issue with respect to pregnancy hormones, but they may not have gotten to it yet. It's it wouldn't necessarily be the easiest thing to research.
Mm-hmm.
The issues with Hazelton has looked at is the issues of birth control on female mate choice. And
oh yeah,
that's actually a significant issue that troubles her, and she's quite disturbed by how that can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on.
All right, next question. All right, next question is about qualifying for a spouse. So, dear Dr. Mm-hmm. Lyle, the podcasts are fantastic, but I'm not going to lie, they have me constantly feeling like I no longer qualify for my wife. We have two kids, and pretty much since we've had one, she really has no desire for me, except, of course, for the 1 week that she wanted to get pregnant with kid number two and was willing to have sex every day that week. Now, I'm smart enough to know that this was not a compliment to me, but just a checkbox on her agenda for kid number two. And to my dismay, even at 40 years old, 1 week was just enough, and now she has pretty much never initiated sex again. My only hope is that she's exhausted, and as you say, survival prioritizes over sex, aka don't overtax. My other hope is that maybe the birth control is contributing to low libido via hormones. Am I spot on with these feelings? What's weird is she stayed with me years ago when I told her that I would date her forever but never saw us getting married. This makes me feel like she was sleeping up back then. But that was my classic breakup line. And now, after listening to you, it makes so much sense why girls immediately pulled the ripcord out right after that. They knew what was going on, even though I didn't even fully realize it until now. What do you think?
Interesting. This man has a lot of company, and and I'm not sure what his situation is. I do know I've got a few things. We were just talking about birth control and the impact that it could possibly have on human sexuality. I would certainly what's reasonable here is that these people need to get first of all, I don't know how old the children are, so that makes a pretty big difference. So if you've got a one-year-old that we're chasing around and caretaking for, then trust me, that woman very likely doesn't have any energy at all for sexuality. Now, if the children are 4 and 6, this is starting to look a little bit different. And so, like I said, since I don't know what the person's particulars are, it's not that easy for me to speak with any confidence at all about how it is that we would approach this. However, in principle, we would want to approach this with a very gentle but frank discussion, and essentially, you want to look at this whole situation kind of openly and open up the discussion by being vulnerable and essentially saying, you know, one of the things that seems like it's changed in our relationship. I know we're up to our ears in trouble and stress, and we've got these two kids, and we're on this adventure that where they have tremendous needs, and we have to answer to them. And I know that it takes a lot out of us. However, the idea of being in a marriage or any relationship, romantic relationship, is to have some romance, to feel like that our partner likes us and we like them. And I just can't help but notice that I just feel like maybe that's not true anymore for you. That this is really, that this is not a place that you feel that that happy about being. And I'm not sure why. And if there's anything that I can do to make that different, you know, I would really want to know. So is there more than I can do, or is there things that I can do differently? Because I don't want you to be unhappy in that area of your life, and I don't want to be unhappy in that area. And so this kind of discussion, I'm just doing this off the top of my head, but this is this kind of discussion in 3 minutes, you can talk straight to people. And if you talk in a way that is not accusing, but is sort of reporting what it is that you see and reporting about what it is that you would hope for, and reporting also that you value the relationship a great deal and that you would want to do what is it make your wife happier, and does she have any intuition about that? This is a, you know, an important discussion, and if she blows it off, that's okay. You can come back and have this discussion again in a month, but she will have heard loud and clear that your wheels are turning, and that you are concerned. You are considering leaving. It's not an open threat, and it's not an angry threat at all. It's just that she will pick up the idea that you are not going to roll over for the rest of your life and have it be just sheer mediocrity. That's not what we're going to do. That in fact we are going to approach this as best we can in a joint exploration to try to figure out whether or not we can recapture some of the closeness and intimacy and sensuality into the relationship that was once there. And we're going to be open to the objections, and we're going to be open to the fact that she may be skittish. She may not feel like she's in a position of power and a possibility of dealing with a possible breakup, et cetera. So there's all kinds of reasons why she might not be ready for any discussion like this. But we can have this discussion quietly, and then we can have it again, and then we can have it again. And so in the months to come, we essentially are continually circling around on these issues so that the person is getting more comfortable and realizing we are not on the edge of freaking out. We're just trying to solve a problem. Okay? And depends upon what you have on the other side. What is truly the nature of this relationship? And if it turns out to be the case that you actually do not qualify and that she's not interested in you doing anything to improve your possibility that you could qualify, and the kids are not 1 year old, they're in fact independent enough that she has time and she has energy and she's not surely exhausted, then that's a whole different set of discussions. So first we go there, and then we see what we have after that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Interesting. This made me think of a question about a friend's breakup. Do you want to talk about this now, or should we leave
sure.
it for later? Yeah.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, a friend of mine recently, you know, he was dating a girl and she broke up with him, and they were pretty mature about everything. But from what he was telling me, he was frustrated because she kept it moved past the point of maturity after they already agreed to break up, but she kept trying mm-hmm. to almost like trying to get him to get upset and cause drama. And we were trying to figure out why that is, you know, why that's happening. And the only thing we could come up with was that she wanted closure and she wanted him to be the bad guy. But it just makes me think, what, you know, in this type of case here, it made me think of it, because when people break up, you know, it's not always the easiest thing. It's not always a mature thing. I mean, people don't always act maturely.
Yeah. Well, sometimes remember, whenever you don't understand something, the right place to look is for status. So whenever you can't understand why somebody's doing what they're doing, if you are puzzled, it is very likely that status is in fact the variable that you're not observing and that you're not understanding. And so in that case, you could have a situation that that the female needed him to act like he was more upset about losing her, and she essentially wanted to be able to report honestly to the village that he was all bent out of shape, which would have signaled that he was the rejected party and she was the rejecting party, which would have defended her mating status.
I see.
Okay. So that would be almost certainly what was motivating her behavior.
Hmm.
So in the aftermath of breakups, I have not paid close attention at all. It's just way out at the periphery of my vision, folks. So far out, it barely has caught my eye is the fact that Brad and Angelina are breaking up or got a divorce. I don't know what has gone on. All right. But I am also very peripherally aware that I was told this secondhand that apparently she accused him of some kind of abuse of their children or some damn thing, whatever the hell it was. Now, this is undoubtedly BS. So this is is it theoretically possible? Of course it's theoretically possible. It's just exceedingly unlikely. So what likely happened is that this is sort of a classic situation where the male, as he ages, is not losing mate value as fast as the female is losing mate value. And so as a result of this, both these people who are, you know, in the top, you know, one ten-thousandth of humanity for sexual attractiveness, they meet, they become the, you know, the tabloid people of the world, and Angelina, of course, gets more credit for landing Brad Pitt than Brad Pitt gets for landing Angelina. Certainly, if you were to tap into the culture's psychology about this, it would be the classic issue that the supremely attractive male is in fact the grand prize of evolution, not the supremely attractive female. That's how that's going to work. So, as a result of this, now you have a situation where he is not losing his extraordinary mate value as fast as she is. And then she has this issue where she was worried about breast cancer because she had some genes, and so therefore she cut her breasts off. Who knows what went on there or why or what the real reasons are. I don't care at all. But what is interesting is that in the aftermath of this breakup, we have now Angelina, apparently, like I said, I don't know if this is even true, but this is what's reported to me, throwing mud on Brad Pitt's reputation. This does not surprise me at all. So this is like the likely truth is that he has moved on. He's interested in other people. So suddenly there's another Angelina somewhere in the wings, or many Angelinas in the wings that are 15 years younger than Angelina. And so that are perfectly interested in Brad Pitt, and he knows that, and he's probably taking advantage of this. Angelina can't handle it, and as a result, what she's going to do, she's going to tar and feather his reputation and say that, in fact, he can't fire me because I quit, or I fired him first because he's a bad person. So this is akin to what it is that your friend is going through with this breakup. It's the same process. Whenever you don't understand, look for status.
Yeah. That's probably exactly what's happening. That's fascinating. And so is there anything that the other party can do to prevent this from happening?
Yes, there is. The right thing to do if somebody could call Brad Pitt, and I wouldn't charge him more than $10,000 for the hour. the thing to do is to go on Oprah Winfrey and let Oprah, you know, act like the brilliant interviewer she is, and, you know, throw him a bunch of softball questions, and to be just handsome as hell. You know, not that, I mean, that goes without saying. The guy never got anything other than an A+ in handsome class. All right, so then. Have Oprah throw you these softball questions about your life and your relationship with Angelina, and then the right thing to do is to pour status on top of Angelina. and have Oprah, you know, the great interviewer, ask the tough question about what she said, and all he can say is, I just love her to death. She's just the greatest, most fascinating person, and I don't know. I have a feeling that other people have maybe told her things for their own designs, and you know, she's such a responsible person that it probably terrified her. And so, no, I don't hold this against her at all. She's just absolutely phenomenal human being, and you know, love is love, and what can you do? And I just, you know, I'd do anything to have us back to where we were, but you can't sometimes recover the past, and all you can do is swallow your pride and move on, and you learn from your mistakes. But, you know, Angelina is the greatest thing that ever walked. That's what you say. That's what you say, no matter what she says. You pound that down the media. It's front page all over the place. You want it, you know, the lead article in Oprah's magazine that she continues remarkably to always make the cover of her own magazine. Doesn't look a day over 35, okay? But the point is that this would be the right strategy to try to defuse this. And so in general, the right strategy is you go to your village. When the other person is throwing mud on you, you go against your genetics. The genes tell you fight back and cut their credibility off at the knees as fast as you can. The proper move to beat the genes is to go exactly the opposite direction and go in big, okay? Go in big, go in loud, go in super positive. They will get that feedback from other people, and it'll be a shock. And it will spin the esteem dynamic in the other direction. It'll be confusing to them, but it'll be gratifying, and it will be immediately the right thing for them to do is to shut up and take a different tactic. It will be in their best interest to do so. So that's how we stop the bleeding in a mess like that.
Well, we are going to continue with the podcast before any of these celebrities hire you as a PR campaign manager.
Okay. All right. Believe me, they got 10 other more highly paid advisors telling them to do different.
What, $10,000 an hour is too much for them? Come on.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. All right, let's go on. What do we got?
All right. Our next question is about kids and pets, which I guess what we've heard before from you is that they're pretty much the same thing in a certain way. Except with kids, you can't sell their children once they grow up, you know? So.
Right. That's a problem. Well, you could.
All right. Go ahead. Dr. Lyle, ever since I was a little kid, I've always adored pets, especially the cute little furry puppies. And when I got older, I was planning to get a puppy of my own. But as soon as I became a father for the first time, it was like a switch turned off. I no longer felt the same way about cute little animals. And when friends bring their dogs with them, I hardly even find it interesting to pet them. What's the mechanism behind this phenomenon? And has my fondness for children been taken over by my emotions for pets?
You know, one of these days, I'll know I'm ready to leave the earth when I've heard it all. Okay. This is a new twist that I've never heard. Now, I've heard something very similar, which is interesting. So I'll tell you what I've heard before, because this man's intuition is pretty interesting, and I have a feeling that something very much like this is going on. So this is way out there in the future for evolutionary psychology for somebody to sniff out and run the appropriate experiments to figure this out or mine the data somehow. It's quite possible that the affection for animals and the intensity of the emotion for animals may have to do with a male circuit demonstrating on the part of male that it's grandstanding that they would be good fathers, and so that once they are fathers, they may the utility of that demonstration may be remarkably less. So that's an interesting possibility, way out there. Don't know. Now here's what it is that I would tell you. I had a client that was extremely competent human, and he did not actually think that he had any paternal motivation, desire, friendliness, anything. So this guy was just an extremely competent business person. And then he got married and had a couple of kids. And he said when he had his first kid, his attitude was that he would kill anybody that would hurt that kid. he says he was very matter of fact. Okay, very matter of fact. This I don't know. This is 20 years ago, and I remember it because he is extremely decent person, and it was very matter of fact, just like he was in business. And he was like, no, he goes, I didn't even know that was in there. Didn't know it was a possibility for him. He had never particularly liked kids, never had any desire, nothing. Has his own kid, and it's like anybody touches this kid, they're dead. So it is very interesting that these mechanisms, I believe, under certain cases, can have something that can look like an on-off switch. And we may have found one inside of this man's head. Remarkable. I myself am crazy about certain pets and not others, but we'll analyze that another day.
Okay, I was just going to ask you, right, but we'll do it another day. Yeah, because yeah. I've all often right, thought about what you said about animals and pets as a display, yeah. And yeah. I've met people who are just adamant that they just don't like kids and they don't want to have kids ever. And I know that you've said that if they ever did have kids, any which way that would most likely change. But I wonder if there's any like personality characteristics that favor people who end up getting irritated by children.
Well, I believe that I'm right. In other words, I think that when they're your own children, it's a whole different kettle of fish completely. So yeah. I am not attracted to people's small children at all. There's a family friend very close to me that toted over her granddaughter for me to see a few weeks ago. And that did, strangely enough, that kid had animation and was hitting my circuits pretty good. And I thought, oh boy, there it is. Okay, so but in general, I think what you're going to find is that scads of us are not the slightest bit interested in children per se, but we would be unbelievably interested in our own. And I think that that's probably even more, far more likely to be true of males than it is females.
Interesting. Yeah. I just had a family gathering, went to a family gathering a couple of weeks back, and the highlight of the evening was playing with the kids because they're the only humans that can't figure out where my magic tricks, like how my magic tricks go. All the adults know where I hide the ball and everything like that. So,
right.
No ego boost there for me. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. All right. What else we got? Sure.
Okay. All right. This might be a long question, so it might be the last one. But sure. Dr. Lyle, please, I would love to hear your thoughts about the marshmallow test, the experiment, the book, and everything surrounding it, and the concept of willpower.
Okay. So let me tell you about what the marshmallow test was. The way back in the day, it was probably the 1960s. A personality psychologist at Stanford by the name of Walter Mischel ran a very simple little test, and it went something like this. So a little kid got a choice that they could either have a marshmallow that they could eat it right in front of them, or if they would wait, can't remember how long it was, short length of time, like a minute or probably less than half a minute, maybe something like that. I can't remember, but it was a short length of time. If the kid did not eat the marshmallow, then they could get two marshmallows. And so it was this very simple delay of gratification test. So Michelle does this test, and then what was interesting is that these kids were followed up, 10 years later or so, because Stanford had a lot of, they got all these educationally interested humans milling around Palo Alto, dragging their kids into Stanford for various studies over the years. So they have a lot of data around their longitudinal data. And so this was some longitudinal data that was able to be mined. And so years later, when they were, young adults, they had run, I think they had, I can't remember, GPAs, it was probably SAT scores, things of this nature. Maybe high school GPA, maybe even college, I can't remember, but they had data showing clear evidence that the kids that had delayed gratification had better scores. And I think the book that they're referring to, I think they have longitudinal data that even goes to the present day. So I think they followed these people many years later and looked at their careers, or I don't even know what they looked at. But the point is, and here's the whole point. The whole point is that that this very simple test wound up being remarkably predictive. I don't know how good the correlation coefficients are in terms of who is really good delay of delay person and had good willpower, et cetera, when they were 6 years old, and how they look at 50. But it's better than nothing. In other words, it's above zero. Now, quite frankly, I have no idea why anybody would make such a big deal out of this. I knew a book agent once that was talking to a friend of mine, and my friend said was. And believe me, this wasn't Dr. Alan Goldhammer. I only got like four friends in the world, so it wasn't him. So this guy was going to write a book on health. And so he's going to write a book on health. So he's talking to this agent about his book. And the agent says, not a book, maybe a paragraph. In other words, you don't have an idea worthy of a book, okay? This study that has gotten remarkable press, I don't know why. I can remember it was presented to me in when I was in school with a bizarre twist and inference. Now, I don't know. I've never read the book that they have done about this or anything much more about it. To me, it's a joke. It's like, okay, well, big deal. You just measured conscientiousness and probably IQ. So that's all we've got there, and we can do that in about 8 seconds, and you did it in a couple of minutes, and no problem. I could do it too. We don't have to do a marshmallow test. We could do it 79 different ways. I can make up in about three in about an hour that we'd come up with the same thing. So but I think that we have to actually. It's just occurring to me. We have to see this in context historically in psychology, and that is Walter Mischel. It was in the heart of what's called the situationist movement in psychology. Walter Mischel really believed that the individual differences in humans were minimal and that situational forces were paramount in deciding individual differences in behavior. And so the concept of the what I talk about, what we call modern behavior genetics, the notion that the genes are driving individual differences, this was not in this guy's vocabulary. And even when it became evident that this was true late in his career, he wasn't gonna choke it down. So Mischel is very much a situationist psychologist. This isn't to his discredit. It starts being to people's discredit when they stick their head in the sand and they don't want to face the phenomenal data from behavior genetics. But he's writing, or the marshmallow test, is happening earlier. And so I think he was probably amazed. Like, hey, look at that. Like, that's incredible. Look at my little test and see what it correlates to 15 years later. It's like, yeah, Walter, it's genetic. Okay? And so but when this was presented to me in school in the 1980s, the inferences that were coming in, I don't know if anybody wrote these, but these are my professors saying, boy, it really looks like it's worth as children trying to coach children into having delay of gratification. Because and they were all interested in how these kids that did delay gratification did it. Like, they would count to 10 or shut their eyes, or I can't remember what they did. different kids had different little strategies, and the investigators were extremely interested in these strategies because they were like, wow, this could be the key to teaching kids willpower. You're not going to teach kids willpower. You are observing the individual differences in willpower. That's what you're saying. You're not going to teach Michael Jordan to jump. You're simply going to watch him that when he's 8 years old, it's like, wow, that kid's really fast and he can jump. It's like, no kidding. He's not learning how to do it. He can just do it. And so that's the marshmallow test, to the best of my knowledge, has nothing particularly novel or interesting other than the fact that a tiny little slice of human behavior that you watch systematically even early in the game can absolutely tell you something extremely important about that and predict that person's future if that particular slice of behavior is a nice little demonstration of one of the big five or IQ. So that's my thinking on the marshmallow test.
Wonderful. Yeah, I talked with you about this before a long time ago. And one of the points that you made was that in one of the groups, the absence of the father, like basically in the African descent group, there was an East Indian group and an African descent group. And the absence of the father in the African descent group was like, they said it was the strongest link to delay of gratification. And I remember you saying, well, it's just the kind of dad who would be willing to leave the kid, you know, with the mom is going to be low conscientiousness. And so he passes down that DNA to the kid.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I'd completely forgotten all about that, but that's just exactly what kind of thing that I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that is not having anything to do with those racial groups per se. Obviously, it's talking about the specific data in a specific study of something that they happen to find.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Enough, you want to do one more question, or I think we're done for the day. Yeah,
we're done for the day. We'll save them for next week, and we'll swing again next week.
All right. Next week, we're going to start with the question about what would a person be like if they were in the middle of the bell curve for every single personality trait? So that's going to be a good question next week. So,
got it. Okay.
All right. Dr. Lyle, as always, love hearing you talk about this stuff. Love it, love it, love it.
All right. Cool. Great to be here. See you all soon.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.